at any given point in time, one of those branches may present itself as being the greatest opportunity of your lifetime. And don't be afraid to move on it. Do we live to work or work to live?
All right, what's up, everybody? Welcome to another round of the Jiggy John Show. Now, I'm back in my home studio. I've been away for a couple of weeks because life is back to normal, or so we appear it to be, or so it appears to be, I should be saying. And today, I've got a very interesting guest. Now, this gentleman, I had the chance of meeting for the first time about 21 years ago, and he has played a pretty instrumental role, at least in the early stages of what I did when I first started off with Jiggy, although nobody knew it was going to continue the way it did. So anyways, this gentleman is right now sitting in Midland, Michigan, 12 hours behind, and it is my professor from university who taught me at Northwood University. And before he comes on, I'm going to show everyone a picture of how we looked like 20 over years ago, and we're going to then bring him on and show him in the true flesh 20 years down the road. Folks, ladies and gentlemen, it is John Gretha on the Jiggy John Show. John!
Hey, Jonathan. How are you, my friend?
Very good. Very, very good. So, this is a long time coming. And I think you understand that as an international student, leaving your home country, leaving your comfort zone, crossing all the way there and coming to a brand new place, it takes, well, one of it is, I call it a leap of faith. For me, it was definitely a leap of faith because you're kind of going out into the unknown and you don't know what the future holds. And going 9,000 kilometers away from home, at that point, 20 over years ago, it was a 22-hour flight time. You know, it was a whole different experience. But I dare say, and I speak on behalf of at least my inner circle, you were one of the key people who made that whole experience a real joy. And I think you were one of the few professors who embraced us the way you did, and you accepted us as international students, and you didn't treat us like any other, like you didn't treat us differently. So how did you just, you know, completely just accept every one of us the way you did with such a big open heart?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. I believe that everybody comes from a place, right? We're all fundamentally human beings. And our own places are always distinct, unique. And as a consequence of that, we all become individuals, right? And so I see an international student as being an individual, just like my next door neighbor is a different individual. And I recognize the fact that, you know, I only know me. And I only become bigger and I only become better by knowing people, figuring out how to know people who are different than I am. So believe it or not, the opening part, it was selfish on my part to want to get to know you, the international students at Northwood, because you brought such different perspectives on how the world works and how your own culture is represented in the world. All of those things were completely, you know, new to me. And so I wanted to, I knew that if I embraced you at some level, it would be, you would be giving me a lot of that. But I'm open to that. And this is something that we don't see everywhere, right? Especially today. Seem to be a lot of places that are throwing up cultural and religious and social distance barriers, right? And to me, that's just fundamentally antithetical to our development as human beings. So that's how it was easy. And plus the fact that I came from a stock that was not traditionally American, right? My father was Swiss. My mother's parents were from the UK. And so that was easily, it's easy for me to see what other people in around the world have to offer.
And I tell you, John, I mean, I honestly believe that if only more people in higher education had, and I'm referring to your fellow Americans here, and I'm going to put it out there, they should take many leaves from the page of John Grether, because I think the way you approached it, you definitely have made a difference in the lives of, I believe, any international student who had the ability to have a class with you, who had the chance to spend time with you, because, and I dare say, you made our experience at university in a foreign country, in a city like Midland, which, you know, is nothing like where we come from here in Kuala Lumpur, at least for us Malaysians. I mean, you've been out here, so you get what I'm talking about from just the life and the vibe. So I think, I mean, I must put it out there. And 20 years later, just literally thank you for just being who you were. And you're still the same person. And I'm pretty sure every international student who has had the opportunity to spend time with you will definitely vouch for that. So I do feel that with what's going on right now, the irony of ICE and what's going on with international students in America, it is just, you know, I feel, I don't even know where this is going to go, but, you know, I really am so grateful that we had that opportunity to have spent that time. I mean, it was 20 years actually, to be exact. So thank you for that. So on that note, let's just talk about you a little bit, because, you know, you've been in education pretty much your whole life, except for that short stint that you had with your own business. So let's talk about you and how is it that you've made education and just teaching and improving the lives of people who sign up for higher education. How have you made that your lifelong calling? Tell me more about that.
Well, I guess the first place to start is the fact that I was the anti-academic as a child and as a young adult. All right. So I went to high school. I guess I was pretty bright, but I would rather spend time with my friends or chasing girls than doing homework, right? So I could do okay in school just by paying attention, and I didn't do a lot of extra work. And I really saw that college was, you know, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I was 18, so I started out as a computer science major.
Right.
Spent a year and a half in college, but still retained too many of my bad habits from high school. And so I decided to stop, and I decided to work for a while. This is just to make a long story short.
Right.
After a few years of working and being very successful at working without a degree at that age in the early 1980s, mid 1980s.
Right.
My father passed, and he had a business. He was a landscape architect. And when he passed, my mother asked me to come home to help run that business. So I came home and ran that business. And then my mom and I started another business.
Okay.
But I had already been married.
Right.
2 years into starting the second business, my wife and I are looking around and we suddenly have two children.
Right.
And so I figured at some point I should probably go back to school.
Okay.
So it was in going back to school and pursuing nothing more than an associate degree at a community college, I got the opportunity to tutor in economics.
Wow.
And I loved it. So I loved tutoring, and I kept that up even after I moved to university. And I kept it up even when I was pursuing my master's degree in economics, which was immediately after this. And I was doing all of this while I was still working full time.
Right, right. Whoa, wow.
With kids, went to school full time, worked
the
full-time.
Quintessential American dream. That's what you guys kind do. Of
pursuit, heavy pursuit, right?
Yeah.
So I was at Northwood, and my mentor there was a guy by the name of Tim Nash. I think remember Tim.
So Tim
said to me, he goes, "Well, you know, you want to go to grad school, right?" And I'm like, "Yep." And so he was instrumental in pushing me that way. And he goes, "You know, if you get your master's degree, you could probably come back here and teach." And he said, "I think you'd be really good."
Oh, yeah. He was right. Spot on.
So he was right. And so that's how it happened. It was kind of serendipitous. I decided to tutor some econ students.
Right.
And I ended up with a 25, 26-year career in higher education as a consequence. Right. So interestingly enough, I had the opportunity to teach a lot of different classes at Northwood. And this was prior to a move in higher education towards greater credentialization. So a person like me today, with my background, probably would never be able to initiate a career in higher education. I am the last of the type.
Wow.
That has a general understanding of a lot of disciplines and has, at least according to my students and my evaluations, you know, the ability to teach a lot of different subjects rather well. Right now, the way the world works is colleges had declining enrollments. And so what they did is they opened up their graduate programs.
Right.
And so everybody's got a master's degree. Everybody can get a PhD in something now. And so the higher education apparatus, in order to continue to bring people in to higher education, needs to find jobs for them. So if you want somebody to get a PhD, they're going to say to you, well, what am I going to do with it? Well, there's a teaching job for you.
Right.
Well, if there wasn't a teaching job for you, why would you do it?
Right.
So what has happened is more and more the accrediting agencies have been focusing on specific, you having to have specific credentials to teach in specific courses. And it used to be that any kind of practical experience with a terminal degree would allow you to teach undergraduate students anything.
Right.
Now it's not that case. Hmm. But because I had the ability to do it for 20 some years, I am still kind of grandfathered in, if you will. And the school I'm currently at sees me as an exception to I fall under their exception to the accreditation rules, and I'm allowed to teach whatever I want, basically.
And you do know right now they are saying the future belongs to the generalists, those who pretty much know enough of everything. You don't need to know everything. You just need to know enough of everything. And and that's it. You're going to, and looks like that's what you've been doing for two decades and longer.
It's I've actually used that as to talk about it. I'm, you know, a long time ago in America, and I don't know if it even holds true in British English, but you know, jack of all trades,
master of none. Exactly.
And I am a master of a few things. I'm a master of being able to think across disciplines.
Of course.
And so if something goes on in law, because I have a law degree, or if something goes on in economics, I can put those two things together and I don't get confused.
No, of course.
I can understand the legal implications of something that happens in international business.
Yep.
I can understand the international business implications of something that happens because of a change in the economy. So again, having a multidisciplinary background and being interested in a lot of things has led me to that place.
Awesome.
Is that a great thing? I don't know. It depends on who's doing the measuring, I guess.
Well,
I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not good at.
Well, to add one feather to your cap, since I took your international marketing, let's just say you could make me your case study, because that's what I'm doing in this neck of the woods. You know, I do literally do work across Asia, and there's been a whole ton of marketing going on there. So I guess I took that one class seriously.
Oh, you were a fun, John. You and your inner circle that were at Northwood together all took school plenty seriously enough. I think you've done well. I mean, again, the American system is perhaps a little bit more forgiving in some ways than a typical Asian education, but I also think it's more experiential and it's more thought-based and it's more problem-solving based. And it trains the mind to not be afraid. Right. Whereas memorization, sometimes it's almost a training in fear.
Yep.
Because if you don't memorize the right things, then the future won't be what it is.
That is
true. And in the American system, we teach you again a little bit enough to say, if you don't know something, just go look it up.
Right.
And take the next step.
So you know, it's funny.
Don't wait to be right.
So do you think that exposure, like especially the whole Western approach, which is, you know, usually pretty much thinking out of the box, and then the Asians go by, you know, it's all very exam and result oriented. So do you think with that kind of exposure, the international students, when they kind of come out there, do you think that they actually tend to excel better than the local students, at least with what you've experienced?
I would tell you that I think that there's maybe some truth to that, right? Because there is a place to have decent memorization skills, I got through law school. I didn't do great because I am not a memorizer. If I can't make logical connections, I have a terrible time remembering something for even 5 minutes.
Right, right.
The way my brain works is almost detrimental to my pursuit of a legal education. It was awesome in economics and learning economics, but I'm serious about that. Okay. So the ability to think in different ways is fundamentally important.
Yep.
And one of my favorite books of the last decade has been Thinking Fast and Slow. And right. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but this idea that our brains learn things in deep ways that become almost instantaneous recall, right? They become habitual. It's habitual responses to certain stimuli.
Yep.
And learning that way, but then also having the ability to break all that apart and think about it in great detail are the two juxtapositions of how the human mind works, right? So any kind of training that you get that allows your brain to work in different dimensions.
Yeah.
So if it's deep critical thinking, or if it is commitment to memory of things that are immediately useful, the degree to which you can put those two things together and then learn how to shift between thinking fast and slow, to me, it's a great thing. And so when I look at students who have gone through different types of educational formats, those who are bright and interested in learning in general have benefited from having exposure to multiple approaches. So I think whether it's an international student in the United States or if it's a U.S. student who chooses to study abroad, it's much the same thing.
Yep. Right.
The other thing, though, that international students bring to the United States and that creates a reasonable difference that most people don't think about is the fact that most Americans are not multilingual.
True.
Almost all Americans are stuck in English as the way they perceive the world, as the way they think. And we can get away with that because English has become the, ironically, lingua franca. it's a replacement for French as a global language.
Yeah.
And so we don't need to worry about learning other languages. But in fact, because of that, there's a fair amount of detriment to how we see the world, how we examine the world culturally, and how we think about global problems. So the international students, because they also, in most cases, have at least command of one other language besides English, typically, that they have different pathways for thinking, and that allows them to look at the world in ways that are a bit more sophisticated, I think.
Well, I'm not going to argue with that. So, in the last two decades, has the landscape of education as a whole, you as an educator especially, has it changed?
Yeah, and it's funny, I talk about this quite often with my colleagues that have taught for a period of time, and we're concerned of, there's a couple concerns.
Yeah.
I'm not sure to what degree it's a question of the educational system or if it's cultural in general, but there are an awful lot of students who believe that they have that their own self-worth should be validated by their classroom experience.
Yep.
So if they have a very, if you tell them that they're not quite where they should be with regard to their understanding of something, they take that as a personal, they take that as attack against them as a person, as opposed to them just understanding that part of being a human being is the fact that we are ignorant of things because our minds are limited, and some of us can learn certain things better than others and understand things in more depth than others. And to walk around with the expectation that everybody's going to tell you that you know well enough about anything is the hard, I think, the biggest thing that we're dealing with right now. Mm. There's also this expectation that earning a degree is somehow should be license itself to earning a living. And I can look at you, John, and I know that it's, that was, other than the experience you had, I don't know that there was much more that you got that has been super helpful for where you are in life.
You know that for a fact because you saw it happen.
The intellect, the mental discipline piece might have been there, right? Yeah. It might have been helpful mental discipline, but I don't know that the university experience added much more mental discipline to you than you had coming out of high school. Maybe a little bit, right? Yeah. But I don't think it was transformative in that way. And so now the question is, if we're going to go down this path, then the question we have to ask ourselves is, what's a college degree worth in the first place?
Ooh, we're threading on thin ice there. But
well, if you ever want to have a more in-depth conversation about this, I mean, I actually have a fairly decent friendship with a guy who has created one of the greatest unlearning college alternative programs in the United States.
Oh, wow.
And basically his position is you can learn what you need to be valuable to other people without going to college. And there are many paths to doing that. And it doesn't mean that you have to go to trade school to do it.
See,
it's not just, and it's amazing. It's
and
amazing
actually, stuff. You saying that literally brings me to my next question, because it's spot on. With all that's going on now, especially with this whole virtual shift, what is the future of education? And you just pretty much said it, you know, what is the value and worth of a college degree anymore? And with all that's going on, this entire paradigm shift, and you're already facing it, you're doing classes virtually and physically, hybrid, so to speak. But what is the future of education?
Well, we actually have this conversation at Kettering University, where I'm at right now. And our president has actually been a party to this conversation, that our real value is in validating that students have specific knowledge and skill sets that they can apply.
Right.
So it's no longer that the degree itself is... The degree represents a combination of skill sets, but we have to be able to validate in the market that our students are able to do these things when they leave. It's if we have any kind of authority or reputation in the market, then we can expand, we can convey that authority and reputation to our students, right? And we can do it at the course level, and we're even doing it now in our continuing education with module levels. And I designed a strategy course that teaches middle entry-level managers that are moving up to middle management how to think about their organization in a strategic fashion, so that they start looking at problems from the big picture as opposed to seeing it as just doing their job. And I created that in 4 modules. And if they complete all 4 modules, they would get credit for a corporate strategy, 400 level corporate strategy course. So what we're doing is we're trying to figure out what the value propositions within each of the courses are to create bits that we can sell independently, because they're valuable in and of themselves. And to the degree that we begin to structure our entire curriculum that way, then it becomes a series of scaffolds that could be purchased in just about any way.
We have to be
able to verify and vouch for and prove the value of what it is we're conveying. And if we can't do that, then we are going to be obsolete. And this is the problem that almost all universities are facing.
So that brings me to the million-dollar question, because, you know, I would say in the last 10 years or so, the amount of technopreneurs who have just made their billions, predominantly North America, and that has cascaded down to Asia now. I mean, you have watched it. We've watched it. I mean, we were at the start of the Amazon. I mean, we have contributed to Bezos billions or trillions at this point, right?
Wow.
I mean, I was there. I mean, I started Jiggy by buying my material on Amazon.com. Come on.
Right.
You know, back in 2000. So paper qualification, what is your take on this? Like, I mean, is it absolutely necessary anymore? Do you need a paper qualification to be successful in life?
No, I don't think so. And I think that's the point we're trying to make, is that if you can find somebody who is willing to pay you, whether it's an employer or the public mm-hmm. in general, if you're going to be a entrepreneur such as yourself, or as I did, as long as you have a way of bringing value to people, I don't think it matters. But if you're going to go work for someone else, again, especially for larger companies, they don't have time or energy to vet the skill sets of all the people that they're trying to hire in various and sundry ways of being able to do things, right? So I need an electrical engineer needs to be able to do these things.
Yep.
Somebody who understands supply chain or project management has to be able to do certain things. What are those skill sets that they have, and are they vouched for?
Yep.
So again, I think college is starting to look more like certification.
Yep.
Unless you want to go into an advanced degree, unless you want to become a researcher, it's going to become a sum of parts thing.
Yep.
So do you need everything in the degree? No, I still think that, most people, even if they're technically good, probably need to know how to read and write and communicate with people and communicate across different ways of thinking. So to the degree that they educate, the broader educational certification, let's say the degree itself, gives that, then it's okay. But again, if we can't vouch for it, if we can't prove that those things are actually happening, then I don't think the degree matters much at all. You look at some of these tech entrepreneurs, right? They didn't need to learn a whole lot. Mm-hmm. They learned what they needed to learn to get started. And then they learned what they needed to learn along the way to be successful. It wasn't you must do this first and then this will come after. It was very much, learn what you need to get to where you need to go. And when we look at something called lean business startup today, even today, this is what it is.
Right.
It is what do you know about your value proposition? Is it enough that you can test it? If you test it, can you tweak it? If you can tweak it, can you sell it?
Yeah.
And you don't make big investments up front. You make all the investments incremental as you learn.
Yep.
And I think higher education is going to slowly, and part of the problem is higher education in most countries is part of the government bureaucracy, either directly or indirectly.
Yep.
And so it changes slowly.
Yep. So, I mean, you've been an academic advisor for this many years. There's one thing that I have noticed, and I think you definitely have seen this. I mean, most people, when it comes to the time in their life when they need to start deciding on college and things like that, it's always do they just follow what's popular, what they think is going to make the bucks? But a lot of them struggle with coming to terms with following their true heart's desires, passion. And then they make that shift either later on in life. I was blessed that, I got into it from the get-go without realizing it. And then it's become a career, a life's journey now. So, I mean, I can understand that angle of it. Like for me, it just kind of fell into place. Obviously, a couple of things happened that got me down this path. It wasn't by choice. If 9/11 didn't happen, I wouldn't have come home and I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing, right? But for you, like, what would your take be on what would your advice be to students? Like, how do they find that deciding factor? Do they go after passion or do they just go after what's trending, what's popular?
Well, what's trending and popular, we live in a world where things change so quickly that chasing the front end, the existing popular trend now is probably a fool's errand because the value is going to be extracted from that before they even get started.
Correct.
What they have to look for is what is the next thing. And to the degree that they have no way of knowing what the next thing is, then having an education background that allows them to see that and or at least approaches their interest in some way, something that they know. But I've always been of the mind, have an idea of the general direction you want to go, but also understand that there are many, many branches off that road.
Right.
And at any given point in time, one of those branches may present itself as being the greatest opportunity of your lifetime. And don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to move on it. Mm-hmm. But that requires, again, open-mindedness.
Yep.
And paying attention to what's going on. And so to the degree that your mind's been not been trained to do that, then I think a college education just to get started might not be a bad place to go. But if you know where your passion lies, mm-hmm. follow that in general, and it will typically lead you to someplace at least where you can wake up every morning and be happy to go to work. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, let's think about this and put it in a greater context. Do we live to work or work to live?
There you go. Yep.
And I believe that we work to live. And yep. So, you know, if we, who we are, what we do for a living should not be the definition of who we are as human beings. And so, yeah, I know a lot of people who have made a fair amount of money who even to this day are unhappy because they still don't know what they want to do. And they aren't even happy with how they live their lives. So.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to flip it up a little bit and put you in the hot seat. So you've taught at Northwood, and I mean, I know you've moved on, and that's a school of management. I mean, you taught it, and you've seen my journey as a business owner, as an entrepreneur. Do you have a question for me?
I have a question for you, and that is, what are you, you say that I've given, that your experience with me gave you something that allowed you to be successful. How have you leveraged that forward to society or your community?
How have I leveraged it forward? Well,
yeah.
The little time that I spent under your tutelage and what I saw you pass down to me, I know for a fact that I have done that instead with even those who have come into working opportunities with me. I mean, I get interns all the time. And when the interns come and when they leave, they always say it was an experience like they never thought that they would come spend 3 months and literally go from event management 101 and leave at event management 401. So right. In 6 months, I give them a master class in event management. So I know for a fact that definitely stemmed from having been around people like you and quite a few others who definitely left a mark in my life.
So then we've both done what we've needed to do to try to be decent human beings, right?
Yes, sir.
Amazing.
Okay, amazing. One last question. Three books, right. Three must reads.
Yeah, you asked me this and I've really not given a lot of thought. For nonfiction, for sure, I would say that everybody needs to read Thinking Fast and Slow. That's a book that takes a little bit to get through. Mm-hmm. But this whole idea of how human brains work and why we forget the things we forget and learn and know and execute on the things we do is super important. It's fundamental to this idea that we cannot know everything.
Yep.
And because we cannot know everything, we need to know a little bit about everything, but yep. also know a lot of other people. And in ways that we can trust them. Yep. So to me, that underlies one of my fundamental philosophical perspectives. A second book that I think everybody should read, and it, some people will say it's sophomoric in terms of its literacy as literature, but is Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
Okay.
That book is a fiction work that describes a society where everybody lives at the expense of everybody else through the government agents and what it means to be a human being and what human life actually ends up looking like if we allow ourselves simply to be pawns in a larger chess match.
Yep.
And then the third book that I would suggest that all of us read regularly is some form of our spiritual guidance. I read the Bible. I think whether you're Jewish and don't read the New Testament, Islam and you're reading the Quran, or whether you're following Lao Tzu in the Taoist tradition or Confucianism, all of those have vital long-term life lessons about life problems that we face on an everyday basis and that we should do our best, you know, give us pathways to doing our best and to live happy and healthy lives. So those are my three.
Thank you. Well, folks, this is John Grether, my professor from university 20 over years ago, who's still teaching 25 years later. He is still in the business. And, you know, I'm pretty sure you are still touching lives, empowering lives. And for that, John, I say thank you. As a former student, I say thank you because you're doing a great job. And I know you do it from the heart. So on that basis, I must say thank you.
Well, you're welcome, and I want to thank you for being the living evidence of what I've strived to help achieve by doing all this. So the feeling is mutual, John, and I hope we get a chance to do something like this sometime again in the future. I'd like to do that.
Who knows? We can do virtual classes together.
Or the Jiggy John Show might just want to ask my opinion on something else.
Who knows? Thank you very much. So thank you for your time, John.
Thank you, John.
All right.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was my guest, John Grether, on the Jiggy John Show. Remember to like, subscribe, and keep following this channel where more great stories will come along. Great people. Stories of tenacity, perseverance, and the whole nine yards. My name is Jiggy John. This is the Jiggy John Show, always bringing you great stories of wonderful people from all across the globe. Stay tuned, like, and subscribe.